Well, in our last session, we looked at the war for independence, and we saw that the nation Israel was actually created formally by the United Nations in 1948. And on May the 15th of 1948, the nation Israel, under David Ben-Gurion, the Prime Minister, and Chaim Weizmann, the President, declared their independence. But they had the sanctioning from the United Nations. And we saw in our last session that all of the surrounding nations mounted a military campaign against them. And it was a huge military campaign. The Jordanians attacked, although they was known as Transjordan at the time. They attacked from the east. The Egyptians attacked from the southwest. The Syrians from the northeast. The Lebanese from the north. The Saudi Arabians from the south, or excuse me, southeast. And the Jews beat them all back. The Jews had no modern weapons. They had no tanks. They had no planes. They had World War I antique weapons that the Czechoslovakians had given them. God wanted that nation to be alive. He wanted them back in the land, just as he's prophesied to them in the book of Ezekiel. As a matter of fact, in a parade during their War of Independence, or after, just before the War of Independence, at the Declaration, David Ben-Gurion was waving the book of Ezekiel when he's walking in that parade. He says, "We're back. We're back. Just as God said we were coming back, we're back." And they beat back all of those nations. God is not going to let his people, the Jews, die. He's not going to let that nation die. And no matter what their opponents, the sons of Ishmael, say, it's not going to happen. So I want to start this evening by looking at the first map, which is of the Armistice Agreement of 1949, and the area in blue of the larger map is what property they have now. If you looked at all the property on that map, that is approximately what God gave them in the Abrahamic covenant. He told Abraham they were going to have property from the easternmost tributary of the Nile Delta all the way up to the River Euphrates and then down into Saudi Arabia and up just north of Lebanon. That's what they're going to get someday, but that's not what they have today. This is what they had after the War of Independence. And the gray area, that little inset area there, the gray area marks the area of Jerusalem and the Old City. And in the War of Independence, Jordan took over the east side of Jerusalem and a whole bunch of land in what has come to be called the West Bank. The Jews and the people that know the scriptures call it Judea and Samaria. Judea and Samaria. That's what that inset there is where the word Jordan is, right about in the middle of the map. And that left the Jews with a very narrow isthmus of property there between that area and the Mediterranean Sea of only about 9 miles. They have a very small amount of real estate. And it's important for us to understand that. Well, I probably should have put that large map that I periodically publish that has all of the Arab nations, or all of the, excuse me, Muslim nations in the Eastern Hemisphere that are just huge, Northern Africa on into Western or Eastern Asia and up into Southwestern Europe and up into Turkey and Southern Russia. I mean, they have a vast amount of area that the Muslims control. And here's this little teeny country, Israel, and they're all trying to get it. They're all trying to squeeze the Jews out. It's because this is a war between Satan and God. Satan is bucking back against God. He doesn't like what God is doing, and he's trying to fight him. And I remember asking one of my professors in seminary, I said, if he knows the Bible, if Satan knows what his end is, why does he keep doing this? Because he doesn't believe it. He may know, but he doesn't believe. He just doesn't believe it. Now, the Egyptian troops overran the Gaza Strip, which is in that southwest part of Israel where the Philistines had historically lived in their 5 cities. And they got to the southern outskirts of Jerusalem, and even though there were huge losses on both sides, the Jews survived this war. There was an armistice agreement that was signed because these countries that had invaded could not beat the Jews. So they signed armistice agreements with Israel, and that was Egypt, Syria, Lebanon, and Transjordan. 1949, Transjordan, which was a created country after the First World War, it didn't exist before. The name was changed to Jordan. King Abdullah Hussein, who is no longer alive, was made king. And you may remember he married a lady named Lisa Halaby from the United States of America. And she's still alive, even though he has died. They have subsequently become a decent friend of the nation Israel. But under the sun now, they're going back to hating Israel. They are the land of Edom. That's the land of Esau. That's where Esau landed. But as a result of this armistice, Jordan got that West Bank area, Judea and Samaria. And it's important that we understand that, because what they did was they started terrorist attacks from that vantage point. And if you think about it, and you look at that map, you can see that they've got a wide border there to conduct terrorist attacks. They've got almost 200 degrees of a circle where they can go in and start attacking Israel on all points there. And that's what they began to do. They started attacking Israel in terrorist activities. They couldn't beat them in an all-out war. They couldn't beat them economically. They couldn't beat them politically, because the world was in favor of giving Israel statehood after the Second World War, when all of the slave and concentration and extermination camps that Hitler had set up had been opened up to the major press, and they came in and took pictures, and the world sympathy for Israel was an all-time high. So it was relatively easy for the Jews to get a national homeland. Now, the next map that I want you to take a look at, it talks about the Arab persecution in the Arab countries. Now, this is kind of interesting, because there were a lot of Arabs that were living in the area that became Israel. And there were about 720,000 of them living there, and they were encouraged by their leaders to flee into their own countries, which there weren't any countries, but all of the surrounding countries, their leaders encouraged them to flee there. So between April and December of 1948, the Arab leaders promised them that, come over here now, we're going to destroy Israel, and then you can go back to where you've been living, and you'll have that without any Jews there. And David Ben-Gurion and a number of the other Israeli leaders told them, if you stay, we will not harm you, and you can be part of our country, because we're going to be a democracy. You can be an integral part of our democracy. You can have full and equal citizenship. They chose to go to the neighboring Arab countries, and a lot of them went into the Judea and Samaria area, and some went a little farther than that. But instead of welcoming them in, what the Arabs did was they put them in refugee camps. Because they told them, they lied to them, and they said, look, you guys go into these, they were concentration camps, you go into these concentration camps and stay here, because we're going to go attack the Jews and kill them all, and then you can go back. So there's no reason for you to integrate fully into our countries over here, because we're just going to quickly wipe out the Jews, and then you can go over there. And they just basically lied to them. They made them political pawns. And that became a pressure cooker. And as time went on, those people that were living there were trying to get food from the United Nations. The Arabs weren't helping them at all. The Jews were giving them some food. The Arabs wouldn't touch them. The Muslims wouldn't help them at all. The Muslims wanted to create a pressure cooker environment to cause those people to lash out against the Jews, which they did. That became the breeding ground for the terrorist groups. And as I said, they were just political pawns. political pawns. Now, the next map shows that there were a lot of Jews living in the Arab countries and had been for 2,500 years. Now, we've seen this in our previous sessions, looking at where the Jews were under Muslim rule. They were viewed as dhimmi. They were just viewed as second-class citizens. They were persecuted, treated very badly. But in 1945, there was about 870,000 of them living in the different Arab states. And that map shows where they came from. And from 47 to 48 and on into 49, these Jews got persecuted severely. When the world attention focused in on the Jews and the Arabs thought that they were going to have to let Israel be a sovereign nation, they started persecuting the Jews. They took their property. There was a whole bunch of anti-Jew riots in Aden and Egypt. Aden is down in the southwest portion of Saudi Arabia, which is Yemen today. Egypt, Libya, Syria, and Iraq. And as a matter of fact, in Iraq, if you were a Jew, that was a capital crime. They would kill you, and that was fair game. If you're a Jew in Iraq in 1947 and 48, you just died. That's all there was to it. There was about 600,000 Jews that were able to escape. That still left quite a few. That left 270,000. But they got destitute. They arrived destitute into Israel. They became a part of the society. They were fed. They were given clothes. They were given places to stay. They were given some work assignments. These are some of the people that set up the kibbutzes and set up the camps where they started doing farming, and they did a lot of irrigation. I mean, Israel is a well-developed country. A lot of very smart people that have been severely persecuted. And so what was essentially happening here? We had an exchange of people. We got the Arabs that were living in Israel that believed the lie from the people outside and went into these internment camps. And then we had a lot of Jews that came from those areas and came back into Israel. And the Jewish folks that came in became full citizens, part of the nation Israel, and the Arabs remained refugees. Now, just try and get that picture in our minds here of these people being put into these camps, lied to, and made prisoner there by the propaganda that they were giving. They were given this propaganda that the Jews hate you, they're going to kill you if you go back, we are going to take care of you, but they didn't take care of them. And it just produced, like the Palestinian Liberation Organization, Hamas, and all the rest of these groups were born in ideologically from that area there. As a result, when the Muslim Arabs were unable to beat the Jews militarily, they started formally raiding in a systematic way into Israel. And the process became known as the Fedayeen Raids. And those raids were roughly 1951 to 1956. And I have a map there showing you where those raids were. And they came from the Gaza Strip, they came from Saudi Arabia, they came from the West Bank region. Some of them came from Lebanon and some from Egypt. And they started systematically coming in with terrorist activities of suicide bombers and bringing guns and grenades and so on and so on. And these nations have been well-armed. They have always been well-armed. And we're going to see where they got their arms in a few minutes. So this, again, this Jordan region here, of Jerusalem, the area where Jerusalem is, West Bank, they're calling it, that really became the seedbed, if you will, of these. And the refugees that lived there were the major perpetrators of the raids in that pressure cooker. So 1,300 Israelis were killed and wounded by the terrorists between 1949 and 56, and the Fedayeen operated in, and they were controlled by Egypt, Lebanon, and Jordan. This is the same terrorist activities that we see every day in the newspaper and every day in the internet and every day on our emails and television and so on. The Muslim nations continue to fight against the Jews. It's a guerrilla warfare. It's one of trying to harm the Jews economically, which they can't really do anymore because the Jews are so brilliant with their money that they're not able to do that. But they were early on because the Jews didn't have anything at the beginning. They arrived there destitute, and they turned that country into a gold mine. So they're not able to do that anymore. But what they have done is a political campaign along with the guerrilla raids to try and convince the world that the Jews are bad, the Jews shouldn't have that territory, they're just terrible people, and they need to be exterminated. And it's a guerrilla economic and a political war that's being carried out right now. And as you know, I've referred to the Joan Peters book quite frequently, from time immemorial. It was written about 30 years ago. Joan got a contract from one of the major publishers to write a book about the poor Palestinians. And I can't remember the name of the publisher, but it may have been Simon & Schuster or Norton or one of the big ones in New York. And she went back to them after she started her research. She said, "I can't write this book." She said, "You know, I got to give you your money back." And they said, "Well, what do you mean you can't write the book?" She says, "That's not what I'm finding out. I'm finding out that they're not poor Palestinians. There never has been a group called Palestine. There never was a country named Palestine. And these people are not poor. It's the Arab nations around them that are causing these problems. The Jews welcomed them to stay when they received statehood, and they wouldn't do it." And a publisher said, "Really? Go ahead and write the book. Sounds even better than the one we asked her to write." So she wrote the book, and it was a bestseller, absolute bestseller. It's a great book. It's extremely detailed because she goes into every UN resolution to prove what it is that happened there. So it's just not her opinion. She has valid proof of everything that happened, and some of which I'm referring to here. In 1956, there was another incursion, if you will, in this fight between Ishmael and Isaac, and it was known then as the Suez War, the Suez Campaign, and it was fought almost all on Egyptian territory in the Sinai Peninsula. Now, what was interesting about this is the way it developed. It started off with Nasser wanting to take control of the Suez Canal. The Suez Canal was owned by France, Israel, Britain, and Egypt. Egypt had a small part of it. Britain owned most of it. They had like a 40% stake in this thing. And Nasser closed it down. He just shut the canal right down to try and see what would happen because he wanted to stop the Israelis from shipping. And that was one economic blockade that he put in place to keep them from having their economy thrive there. Because if they couldn't ship, they were going to be and have a real difficult time getting goods and services out and into the country. This whole thing was a financial disaster. And Nasser ended up nationalizing the canal and saying, "Look, I don't care who owns it. I'm taking control. I'm taking control of this. We now, as Egypt, own this canal. I know you folks here have built it, and you guys put your money into it, and you made it, and so on." And this goes back, I think, into the 1880s or so, when it was first built. And at that time, Egypt was a fledgling country. It was just nothing like the world power that it was several thousand years ago, and not even as much as it is today. So they were sort of happy that it was going to happen because it was going to bring some trade through there for them. You know, it kept people from having to go around Africa in a trade route so they could go through the Suez Canal. Well, what happened was there was a highly corrupt Egyptian king called King Farouk, and he was really a sleazy guy. But he had made deals with the West, and they were paying him a lot of money to keep this canal open, so he didn't care about Islam, he didn't care about Arabs, he didn't care about any of that stuff. He cared about his backsheesh. You know, you keep paying me, everything's fine. You can keep the canal open. He's sort of like the Mubarak of today, that got along better with the West than he did with his people because the West was giving him a lot of money and a lot of authority. So he liked that. Well, he got kicked out. There was a coup. He got kicked out, and a guy named Gamal Abdel Nasser came in. Nasser was very nationalistic and didn't care about Britain and France and wanted to harm Israel. So as far as he was concerned, the canal czars, you guys are out. And throughout this conflict, the Israelis were conducting these sorties or these raids into Sinai to try and stop this and get this canal back. And Egypt kept defending itself, but it was the Israelis that initiated this after the canal was shut down. So the canal's blocked. Israel shipping is blocked. The British banks hold 40% of this. So Anthony Eden, the prime minister in Great Britain, he gets a political campaign up to build a military force from France and Israel. Now, Israel, by that time, had an army and themselves and the Brits. And they were going to go down there and they were going to take the canal back. Well, what he was saying to the Brits in order to get them stirred up was saying, hey, this is the same stuff that Hitler did 20-some years ago. You know, we have got to take this thing back. We can't let this happen. This is going to destroy our economy by dramatically raising the cost for our goods and services by having that shipping now not go through that quick route through the Suez Canal, but have to go from Asia all the way around Africa and then up into Great Britain. And everybody knew what that was going to do to the economy. It was going to just double the cost of things. So they were all in favor of it, and they let them do it. So on October the 29th, Israel invades, and they've got these other armies with them. And Nasser's got the Egyptians all stirred up. They think it's just great. They're just, you know, screaming in the streets about how wonderful this is. Sort of like what happened in the Arab countries when 9/11 happened. There was world press covering them, cheering that they toppled the United Nations, or they toppled the United States. This campaign was progressing pretty good. The Arabs were losing, and the Israelis were approaching the canal. And the whole episode ended. They didn't take the canal back right away. The invading force withdrew in 1957 from pressure from the United States. The United States intervened in this process and says, hey, you guys got to stop. Come on, stop this. Stop this altogether. And the United States convened a United Nations Council, if you will, and they said, we'll put some peacekeeping forces in there. Egypt can keep the canal, but the canal's got to open. You got to open it to shipping because this is going to really disrupt the economy in the Eastern Hemisphere by not having that canal open. So that's what happened. But the real significance here in biblical prophecy for us to see is that the United States came into this knowing that the Soviets were supplying weaponry to all the countries around Israel. The United States started funneling money into Israel. The Soviets were funneling money and arms into all these other countries. And the United States did not want to have a confrontation with the Soviets at that time. That's why this thing stopped. Israel backs out. Israel can't take over the canal, but as far as they were concerned, they didn't really care because the canal was opened, and that's really what they wanted. There were a few thousand casualties, most of them Egyptian. Egypt was the one that lost, but the bigger scope of this, these two superpowers came together as like the focal points of the East and the West, and this is going to end when those events from Ezekiel 38 and 39 happen. There will be a war, and the Eastern Bloc, as Ezekiel 39 says, will lose their world political power. And that's going to happen. That's still yet future to us someday. And you remember that when we went through all of that, especially those of you that are with me in the book of Revelation, that when Jesus talked about the times of the Gentiles, he was talking about all the nations that are laid out in the book of Daniel. And you get beyond the Bible and you get to 364 AD, when the Roman Emperor Valentinian split the Roman Empire in two, and it stayed that way. The eastern side became the Soviets and ultimately the Muslim nations, and the western became the Western democracies and on into the United States. And that division is still there. Still there. You can see the rise of Putin today. The Soviets have never gone away. These people that hate the United States have never gone away, even though we like to think that the Soviet Union was toppled under Ronald Reagan. Well, it sort of was for a time being, but we got the head of the KGB that's the president over there, so it's the same guys, you know, same guys, same world scene, and it all came to a focus here, and at the Suez Canal crisis. And the United States did not want a confrontation with the Soviets because they knew the Soviets were funding all these groups there. So that one just sort of backed off. The next big event, and I'm just going to introduce this tonight, and then we'll talk about it more next week, was the Six-Day War in 1967. The Six-Day War in 1967 started with, started months and months earlier, and I've got a map that shows you where the forces came from surrounding Israel, and the number of the soldiers, the tanks, and the jets from the opposing armies. Now, if you look at just Egypt alone, there's 270,000 soldiers, 1,400 tanks, and 550 jets. And what we're going to see in our next session is almost all of them were decimated by the Jews. Almost all of those were decimated. It became really clear in 1966 that the Arab Muslims were escalating a activity to take down the Jews. They have never given up. They've never given up. This has been going on now since somewhere around 1500 BC. And has never stopped. More and more Israeli civilians were being killed in these Fedayeen attacks, and they were coming from Syria and Jordan. And there is a no-man's buffer zone on the border with Syria called the Golan Heights. The Golan Heights is extremely important for Israel to keep because it pushes those people away. It gives them a no man's land. Periodically, the Jews will go in there with bulldozers and they will take out the landmines that the Syrians have planted. But this never stops. On May the 15th of 1967, the Egyptians moved their forces into the Sinai, and they expelled, but 3 days later, they expelled that UN peacekeeping force that had been there since 1956. They said, you guys are out of here. We're taking the Sinai back, and you've got nothing. You can't stay here. So on the 22nd, the Egyptians closed the Straits of Tehran, and that would be the Gulf of Aqaba to us, to Israeli shipping. So again, they were trying to harm them economically. And the Egyptians encouraged Syria, Jordan, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia to move their troops up to Israel's border. And in the weeks leading up to this, the Arab leaders just threatened the Jews constantly on the national press. They went out to the national press. They really thought that they had a right to that little teeny piece of property called Israel. And they thought that there was nothing wrong with ejecting the UN peacekeeping force, closing the Straits of Tehran and putting all of these troops around there. And I've put a number of quotes here. I'm just going to read a few of them to you. They're specific quotes that were made at that time. Nasser, on November the 18th, said, of 1965 even. He says, our aim is the full restoration of the rights of the Palestinian people. In other words, we aim at the destruction of the state of Israel. The immediate aim, perfection of Arab military might. National aim, the eradication of Israel. Now, this is 2 years before the 1967 war. And remember now that the Jews got their independence from the United Nations. They started coming in, and they were persecuted in the Arab nations around them. The Arabs would not take their people and bring them into their countries from Israel. They forced them into those internment camps. And it's that sympathy that they lied about in the national press that they wanted the world to see and get on their side and think that, well, yeah, we do have to exterminate Israel. And most of the press still believes this stuff today. Most of the liberals in the world press still believe this. Here's what he says in 1967, Palestine Day, as they call it. Brothers, it is our duty to prepare for the final battle in Palestine. And on May the 27th of 67, he said, our basic objective will be the destruction of Israel. The Arab people want to fight. The mining of Sharm el-Sheikh is a confrontation with Israel. Adopting this measure obligates us to be ready to embark on a general war with Israel. Well, Sharm el-Sheikh was a town at the southern tip of the Sinai Peninsula that the Israelis had been in and had for quite a while. And the Egyptian ships came there and they started shelling them. And they were taking the aggressive stance there. So I'm not going to read through all these quotes, but I give you those to look at. And you can see that the Arabs were trying as hard as they could to exterminate the Jews. Nothing's changed. They're still doing exactly the same thing. So in our next session, we'll look at the Six-Day War and beyond from there. And then after we look at the war and we look at what is taking place today, then we'll start into what biblical prophecy says about how this is going to end up. What happens in the future? How do these nations fare? What does the Bible, specifically Isaiah and Jeremiah, say about the end of these nations? It's a fascinating story, isn't it? Just absolutely fascinating. You see that what God says is going to happen, happens. He said that these people are going to be fighting, and they are still fighting, but it will stop. He promises us that it will stop someday. And when the events of Ezekiel 38 and 39 happen, and the coalition of Muslim nations headed by the Russians takes place, what will happen at that point in time is the coalition nation, or all of them, will lose all their political power. They won't have any more political prowess in the world scene. And it will only be the Western democracies that are left in a world political position. And that will be the seedbed for that one world government that's going to happen someday. Well, hopefully we're gone by then. I don't want to be around to see it. I don't know when the Lord's going to take us out of here, but he could take me today, you know, that'd be just fine. Does anybody have any questions? Or, well, Jim.
Yeah. When